He didn't mind me getting my hands dirty, and it didn't matter if I pissed off his wife by barging into her house and stopping her.
Stopping her what?
Ah, said Raphael. Food. The dim sum placed on the table before them, the waitress retreated.
What did you stop Kinvara doing? Robin repeated.
Leaving your father, hurting herself? I love this stuff, said Raphael, examining a prawn dumpling.
She left a note, persisted Robin, saying she was leaving. Did your father send you down there to persuade her not to go? Was he afraid Izzy would egg her on to leave him?
Do you seriously think I could persuade Kinvara to stay in the marriage? Never having to lay eyes on me again would have been one more incentive to go.
Then why did he send you to her?
I've told you, said Raphael. He thought she was going to do something stupid.
Raph, said Robin, you can keep playing silly buggers.
He corpsed.
Christ, you sound Yorkshire when you say that. Say it again.
The police think there's something fishy about your story of what you were up to that morning, said Robin, and so do we. That seemed to sober him up.
How do you know what the police are thinking?
We've got contacts on the force, said Robin.
Raph, you've given everyone the impression that your father was trying to stop Kinvara hurting herself, but nobody really buys that. The stable girl was there, Tegan. She could have prevented Kinvara from hurting herself.
Raphael chewed for a while, apparently thinking.
All right, he sighed. All right, here it is. You know how Dad had sold off everything that would raise a few hundred quid, or given it to Peregrine?
Who?
All right, Pringle, said Raphael, exasperated. I prefer not to use their stupid bloody nicknames.
He didn't sell off everything of value, said Robin.
What do you mean?
That picture of the mare and foal is worth 5 to 8.
Robin's mobile rang. She knew from the ringtone that it was Matthew.
Aren't you going to get that?
No,
said Robin.
She waited until the phone had stopped ringing, then took it out of her bag.
Matt, said Raphael, reading the name upside down.
That's the accountant, is it?
Yes, said Robin, silencing the phone, but it immediately began to vibrate in her hand instead.
Matthew had called back.
Block him, suggested Raphael.
Yes, said Robin. Good idea.
All that was important to her right now was keeping Raphael cooperative. He seemed to enjoy watching her block Matthew. She put the mobile back in her bag and said,
Go on about the paintings.
Well, you know how Dad had offloaded all the valuable ones through Drummond?
Some of us think £5,000 worth of picture is quite valuable, said Robin, unable to help herself.
Fine, Ms. Lefty, said Raphael, suddenly nasty. You can keep sneering about how people like me don't know the value of money.
Sorry, said Robin quickly, cursing herself.
I am, seriously. Look, I've been trying to find a room to rent this morning. £5,000 would change my life right now.
Oh, said Raphael, frowning.
Okay. Actually, if it comes to that, I'd leap at the chance of 5 grand in my pocket right now. But I'm talking about seriously valuable stuff, worth tens and hundreds of thousands, things that my father wanted to keep in the family. He'd already handed them on to little Pringle to avoid death duties. There was a Chinese lacquer cabinet, an ivory workbox, and a couple of other things. But there was also the necklace.
Which, it's a big, ugly diamond thing, said Raphael.
And with a hand not spearing dumplings, he mimed a thick collar. Important stones. It's come down through 5 generations or something, and the convention was that it went to the eldest daughter on her 21st, but my father's father, who, as you might have heard, was a bit of a playboy, this is the one who married Tinky the nurse.
She was his 3rd or 4th, said Raphael, nodding. I could never remember.
Anyway, he only had sons, so he let all his wives wear the thing in turn, then left it to my father, who kept the new tradition going. His wives got to wear it. Even my mother got a shot. And he forgot about the handing on to the daughter on her 21st bit. Pringle didn't get it, and he didn't mention it in his will.
So, wait, do you mean it's now?
Dad called me up that morning and told me I had to get hold of the bloody thing. Simple job. Kind of thing anyone would enjoy, he said sarcastically. Bust in on a stepmother who hates my guts, find out where she's keeping a valuable necklace, then steal it from under her nose.
So you think your father believed that she was leaving him and was worried that she was going to take it with her?
I suppose so, said Raphael.
How did he sound on the phone?
I told you this. Groggy. I thought it was a hangover. After I heard he'd killed himself,
Raphael faltered.
Well?
To tell you the truth, said Raphael, I couldn't get it out of my head that the last thing Dad wanted to say to me in this life was, run along and make sure your sister gets her diamonds. Words to treasure forever, eh?
At a loss for anything to say, Robin took another sip of wine, then asked quietly,
Do Izzy and Fizzy realize the necklace is Kinvara's now?
Raphael's lips twisted in an unpleasant smile.
Well, they know it is legally, but here's the really funny thing. They think she's going to hand it over to them. After everything they've said about her, after calling her a gold digger for years, slagging her off at every possible opportunity, they can't quite grasp that she won't hand the necklace over to Fizzy for Flopsy, damn it, Florence, because, he affected a shrill upper-class voice,
Darling, even TTS wouldn't do that. Belongs in the family. She must realize she can't sell it.
Bullets would bounce off their self-regard. They think there's a kind of natural law in operation, where chisels get what they want, and lesser beings just fall into line.
How did Henry Drummond know you were trying to stop Kinvara keeping the necklace? He told Cormoran you went to Chisel House for noble reasons.
Raphael snorted. Cat's really out of the bag, isn't it?
Yeah, apparently Kinvara left a message for Henry the day before Dad died, asking where she could get a valuation on the necklace.
Is that why he phoned your father that morning?
Exactly. To warn him what she was up to.
Why didn't you tell the police all this?
Because once the others find out she's planning to sell it, the whole thing's going to turn nuclear. There'll be an almighty row, and the family'll go to lawyers and expect me to join them in kicking the shit out of Kinvara. And meanwhile, I'm still treated like a second-class citizen, like a fucking courier, driving all the old paintings up to Drummond in London and hearing how much Dad was getting for them, and not a penny of that did I ever see. I'm not getting caught up in the middle of the great necklace scandal. I'm not playing their bloody game. I should have told Dad to stuff it the day he phoned, said Raphael. But he didn't sound well, and I suppose I felt sorry for him or something, which only goes to prove they're right. I'm not a proper bloody chisel.
He had run out of breath. Two couples had joined them in the restaurant now. Robin watched in the mirror as a well-groomed blonde did a double take at Raphael as she sat down with her florid, overweight companion.
So, why did you leave, Matthew? Raphael asked.
He cheated, said Robin. She didn't have the energy to lie.
Who with?
She had the impression he was seeking to redress some kind of power balance. However much anger and contempt he had displayed during outburst about his family, she had heard the hurt too.
With a friend of his from university, said Robin.
How did you find out?
A diamond earring in our bed.
Seriously?
Seriously, said Robin. She felt a sudden wave of depression and fatigue at the idea of travelling all the way back to that hard sofa in Wembley. She had not yet called her parents to tell them what had happened.
Under normal circumstances, said Raphael, I'd be putting the moves on you. Well, not right now, not tonight, but give it a couple of weeks. Trouble is, I look at you.
He raised a forefinger and pointed first to her and then to an imaginary figure behind her. And I see your one-legged boss looming over your shoulder.
Is there any particular reason you feel the need to mention him being one-legged?
Raphael grinned.
Protective, aren't you?
No, I...
It's all right.
Izzy fancies him, too.
I never...
Defensive, too.
Oh, for God's sake, said Robin, half-laughing.
And Raphael grinned. I'm having another beer. Drink that wine, why don't you? He said, indicating her glass, which was still two-thirds full. When he had procured another bottle, he said with a malevolent grin, Izzy's always liked bits of rough. Did you notice the charged look from Fizzy to Izzy when Jimmy Knight's name was mentioned?
I did, actually, said Robin. What was that about?
Freddy's 18th birthday party, said Raphael, smirking. Jimmy crashed it with a couple of mates, and Izzy, how do I put this delicately, lost something in his company.
Oh, said Robin, astonished.
She was blind drunk. It passed into family legend. I wasn't there. I was too young. Fizzy's so amazed at the idea that her sister could have slept with the estate carpenter's son that she thinks he must have some sort of supernatural demonic sex appeal. That's why she thinks Kinvara was slightly on his side when he turned up asking for money.
What? Said Robin sharply, reaching for her notebook again, which had fallen closed.
Don't get too excited, said Raphael. I still don't know what he was blackmailing Dad about. I never did. Not a full member of the family, you see, so not to be fully trusted. Kinvara told you this at Chisel House, don't you remember? She was alone at home the first time Jimmy turned up. Dad was in London again. From what I've pieced together, when she and Dad first talked it over, she argued Jimmy's case. Fizzy thinks that's down to Jimmy's sex appeal. Would you say he's got any?
I suppose some people might think he has, said Robin indifferently, who was making notes.
Kinvara thought your father should pay Jimmy his money, didn't she?
From what I understand, said Raphael, Jimmy didn't frame it as blackmail on the first approach. She thought Jimmy had a legitimate claim and argued for giving him something.
When was this, do you know?
Search me, said Raphael, shaking his head.
I think I was in jail at the time. Bigger things to worry about.
Guess, he said for the second time, how often any of them have asked me what it was like in jail.
I don't know, said Robin cautiously.
Fizzy, never. Dad, never.
You said Izzy visited?
Yeah. He acknowledged with a tip of the bottle to his sister.
Yeah, she did, bless her. Good old Talks has made a couple of jokes about not wanting to bend over in the shower.
I suggested, said Raphael with a hard smile, that he'd know all about that kind of thing, what with his old pal Christopher sliding his hand between young men's legs at the office. Turns out it's serious stuff when some hairy old convict tries it, but harmless frolics for public schoolboys.
He glanced at Robin.
I suppose you now know why Dad was taunting that poor bloke Amir.
She nodded.
Which Kinvara thought was a motive for murder, said Raphael, rolling his eyes. Projection, pure projection. They're all at it.
Kinvara thinks Amir killed Dad because Dad had been cruel to him in front of a room full of people.
Well, you should have heard some of the things Dad was saying to Kinvara by the end.
Fizzy thinks Jimmy Knight might have done it because he was angry about money. She's bloody angry about all the family money that's vanished, but she can't say that in so many words, not when her husband's half the reason it's gone. Izzy thinks Kinvara must have killed Dad because Kinvara felt unloved and sidelined and disposable. Dad never thanked Izzy for a damn thing she did for him, and didn't give a toss when she said she was leaving. You get the picture? None of them have got the guts to say that they all felt like killing Dad at times. Not now he's dead, so they project it all onto someone else. And that, said Raphael, is why none of them are talking about Geraint Wynne. He gets double protection because St. Freddy was involved in Wynne's big grudge. It's staring them in the face that he had a real motive, but we're not supposed to mention that.
Go on, said Robin, her pen at the ready.
Mention.
No, forget it, said Raphael. I shouldn't have.
I don't think you say much accidentally, Raph. Out with it.
He laughed.
I'm trying to stop fucking over people who don't deserve it. It's all part of the Great Redemption Project.
Who doesn't deserve it?
Francesca, the little girl I, you know, at the gallery. She's the one who told me. She got it from her older sister, Verity.
Verity, repeated Robin.
Sleep-deprived, she struggled to remember where she had heard that name. It was very like Venetia, of course. And then she remembered. "Wait," she said, frowning in her effort to concentrate. "There was a Verity on the fencing team with Freddy and Rhiannon Wynne."
"Right in one," said Raphael.
"You all know each other," said Robin wearily, unknowingly echoing Strike's thought as she started writing again.
"Well, that's the joy of the public school system," said Raphael. "In London, if you've got the money, you meet the same 300 people everywhere you go. Yeah, when I first arrived at Drummond's Gallery, Francesca couldn't wait to tell me that her big sister had once dated Freddy. I think she thought that made the pair of us predestined or something." "When she realized I thought Freddy was a bit of a shit," said Raphael, "she changed tack and told me a nasty story. Apparently, at his 18th, Verity and a couple of others decided to mete out some punishment to Rhiannon for having dared to replace Verity on the fencing team. In their view, she was, I don't know, a bit common, a bit Welsh. So they spiked her drink. All good fun. Sort of stuff that goes on in the dorm, you know. But she didn't react too well to neat vodka. Or maybe, from their point of view, she reacted really well. Anyway, they managed to take some nice pictures of her, to pass around among themselves. This was in the early days of the Internet. These days, I suppose, 500,000 people would have viewed them in the first 24 hours. But Rhiannon only had to endure the whole fencing team and most of Freddy's mates having a good gloat. Anyway, said Raphael, about a month later, Rhiannon killed herself.
Oh, my God, said Robin quietly.
Yeah, said Raphael. After little Franny told me the story, I asked Izzy about it. She got very upset, told me not to repeat it, ever. But she didn't deny it. I got lots of nobody kills themselves because of a silly joke at a party bluster, and she told me I mustn't talk about Freddy like that. It would break Dad's heart. Well, the dead don't have hearts to break, do they? And personally, I think it's about time somebody pissed on Freddy's eternal flame. If he hadn't been born a chisel, the bastard would have been in Borstal. But I suppose you'll say I can talk after what I did.
No, said Robin gently. That isn't what I was going to say.
The pugnacious expression faded from his face. He checked his watch. I'm going to have to go. I've got to be somewhere at 9.
Robin raised her hand to signal for the bill. When she turned back to Raphael, she saw his eyes moving in routine fashion over both the other women in the restaurant, and in the mirror she saw how the blonde tried to hold his gaze.
"You can go," she said, handing over her credit card to the waitress. "I don't want to make you late."
"No, I'll walk you out."
While she was still putting her credit card back into her handbag, he picked up her coat and held it up for her.
"Thank you."
"No problem."
Out on the pavement, he hailed a taxi.
"You take this one," he said. "I fancy a walk, clear my head. I feel as though I've had a bad therapy session."
"No, it's all right," said Robin. She didn't want to charge a taxi all the way back to Wembley to Strike. "I'm going to get the tube. Good night."
"Night, Venetia," he said.
Raphael got into the taxi, which glided away, and Robin pulled her coat more tightly around herself as she walked off in the opposite direction. It had been a chaotic interview, but she had managed to get much more than she had expected out of Raphael. Taking out her mobile again, she phoned Strike. Chapter 59 We Two Go With Each Other. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. When he saw Robin was calling him, Strike, who had taken his notebook out of the Tottenham for a drink, pocketed the former, downed the remainder of his pint in one, and took the call out onto the street. The mess that building works had made of the top of Tottenham Court Road, the rubble-strewn channel where a street had been, the portable railings and the plastic barricades, the walkways and planks, that enabled tens of thousands of people to continue to pass through the busy junction, was so familiar to him now that he barely noticed them. He had not come outside for the view, but for a cigarette. And he smoked too while Robin relayed everything that Raphael had told her. Once the call was over, Strike returned his mobile to his pocket and absent-mindedly lit himself a third cigarette from the tip of the second and continued to stand there, thinking deeply about everything she had said and forcing passers-by to navigate around him. A couple of things that Robin had told him struck the detective as interesting. Having finished his third cigarette and flicked it into the open abyss on the road, Strike retreated inside the pub and ordered himself a second pint. A group of students had now taken his table, so he headed into the back, where high bar stools sat beneath a stained-glass cupola whose colours were dimmed by night. Here, Strike took out his notebook again and re-examined the list of names over which he had pored in the early hours of Sunday, while he sought distraction from thoughts of Charlotte. After gazing at it again, in the manner of a man who knows something is concealed there, he turned a few pages to reread the notes he had made of his interview with Della. Large, hunchbacked and motionless, but for the eyes flicking along the lines he had scribbled in the blind woman's house, Strike unknowingly repelled a couple of timid backpackers who had considered asking whether they might share his table and take the weight off their blistered feet. Fearing the consequences of breaking his almost tangible concentration, they retreated before he noticed them. Strike turned back to the list of names. Married couples, lovers, business partners, siblings. Pairs. He flicked further backwards to the pages to find the notes he had made during the interview with Oliver, who had taken them through the forensic findings. A two-part killing, this. Amitriptyline and helium. Each potentially fatal on its own, yet used together. Pairs. Two victims killed 20 years apart, a strangled child and a suffocated government minister, the former buried on the latter's land. Pairs. Strike turned thoughtfully to a blank page and made a new note for himself. Francesca. Confirm story. Chapter 60. You really must give me some explanation of your taking this matter, this possibility, so much to heart. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. The following morning, a carefully worded official statement about Jasper Chisel appeared in all the papers. Along with the rest of the British public, Strike learned over his breakfast that the authorities had concluded that no foreign power or terrorist organisation had been involved in the untimely death of the Minister for Culture, but that no other conclusion had yet been reached. The news that there was no news had been greeted online with barely a ripple of interest. The local postboxes of Olympic winners were still being painted gold, and the public was basking in the satisfied afterglow arising from a triumphant Games, its unspent enthusiasms for all things athletic, now concentrated on the imminent prospect of the Paralympics. Chisel's death had been filed away in the popular mind as the vaguely inexplicable suicide of a wealthy Tory. Keen to know whether this official statement indicated that the Met investigation was close to concluding, Strike called Wardle to find out what he knew. Unfortunately, the policeman was no wiser than Strike himself. Wardle added, not without a certain irritability, that he had not had a single day off in 3 weeks, that the policing of the capital while the city heaved under the weight of millions of extra visitors was complex and onerous past Strike's probable understanding, and that he didn't have time to go ferreting for information on unrelated matters on Strike's behalf.
"Fair enough," said Strike, unfazed. "Only asking. Say hello to April for me."
"Oh, yeah," said Wardle, before Strike could hang up.
"She wanted me to ask you what you're playing at with Lorelei."
"Better let you go, Wardle. The country needs you," said Strike. And he hung up on the policeman's grudging laugh.
In the absence of information from his police contacts,
and with no official standing to secure him the interviews he desired. Strike was temporarily stymied at a crucial point in the case, a frustration no more pleasant for being familiar. A few phone calls after breakfast informed him that Francesca Pullum, Raphael's sometime colleague and lover from Drummond's Gallery, was still studying in Florence, where she had been sent to remove her from his pernicious influence. Francesca's parents were currently on holiday in Sri Lanka. The Pullum's housekeeper, who was the only person connected with the family that Strike was able to reach, refused point-blank to give him telephone numbers for any of them. From her reaction, he guessed the Pullums might be the kind of people who'd run for lawyers at the very idea of a private detective calling their house. Having exhausted all possible avenues to the holidaying Pullums, Strike left a polite request for an interview on Geraint Wynne's voicemail, the fourth he had made that week. But the day wore on, and Wynne didn't call back. Strike couldn't blame him. He doubted that he would have chosen to be helpful had he been in Wynne's shoes. Strike had not yet told Robin that he had a new theory about the case. She was busy in Harley Street, watching Dodgy Doc, but on Wednesday she called the office with the welcome news that she had arranged an interview with Tegan Butcher on Saturday at Newbury Racecourse.
"Excellent," said Strike, cheered by the prospect of action,
and striding through to the outer office to bring up Google Maps on Robin's computer.
"Okay, I think we're going to be looking at an overnighter. Interview Tegan, then head over to Stedder Cottage once it gets dark."
"Cormoran, are you serious about this?" said Robin. "You genuinely want to go digging in the dell?"
"That sounds like a nursery rhyme," said Strike vaguely, examining B roads on the monitor. "Look, I don't think there's anything there. In fact, as of yesterday, I'm sure of it."
"What happened yesterday?"
"I had an idea. I'll tell you when I see you. Look, I promised Billy I'd find out the truth about his strangled child. There's no other way to be totally sure, is there, other than digging. But if you're feeling squeamish, you can stay in the car."
"And what about Kinvara? We'll be on her property."
"We'll hardly be digging up anything important. That whole area's waste ground. I'm going to get Barclay to meet us there after dark. I'm not much good for digging. Will Matthew be okay if you're away overnight Saturday?"
"Fine," said Robin, with an odd inflection that made Strike suspect that he wouldn't be fine about it at all.
"And you're okay to drive the Land Rover?"
Is there any chance we could take your BMW instead?"
"I'd rather not take the BMW up that overgrown track. Is there something wrong with the—"
"No," said Robin, cutting across him. "That's fine. Okay, we'll take the Land Rover."
"Great. How's Dodgy?"
"In his consulting rooms. Any news on Amir?"
"I've got Andy trying to find the sister he's still on good terms with."
"And what are you up to?"
"I've just been reading the Real Socialist Party website."
"Why?"
"Jimmy gives quite a lot away in his blog posts, places he's been and things he's seen. You okay to stay on Dodgy till Friday?"
"Actually," said Robin, "I was going to ask whether I could take a couple of days off to deal with some personal business."
"Oh," said Strike, brought up short.
"I've got a couple of appointments I'd rather not miss," said Robin. It wasn't convenient to Strike to have to cover Dodgy Doc himself, partly because of the continuing pain in his leg, but mainly because he was eager to continue chasing down confirmation of his theory on the Chisel case. This was also very short notice to ask for 2 days' leave. On the other hand, Robin had just indicated a willingness to sacrifice her weekend to a probable wild goose chase into the dell.
"Yeah, okay. Everything all right?"
"Fine, thanks. I'll let you know if anything interesting happens with Dodgy. Otherwise, we should probably leave London at 11ish on Saturday."
"Baron's Court again?"
"Would it be all right if you meet me at Wembley Stadium Station? It would just be easier because of where I'm going to be on Friday night."
This, too, was inconvenient. A journey for Strike of twice the length and involving a change of tube. "Yeah, okay," he said again.
After Robin had hung up, he remained in her chair for a while, pondering their conversation.
She had been noticeably tight-lipped about the nature of the appointments that were so important that she didn't want to miss them. He remembered how particularly angry Matthew had sounded in the background of his calls to Robin to discuss their pressured, unstable, and occasionally dangerous job. She had twice sounded distinctly underwhelmed about the prospect of digging in the hard ground at the bottom of the dell, and now asked to drive the BMW rather than the tank-like Land Rover. He had almost forgotten his suspicion of a couple of months ago that Robin might be trying to get pregnant. Into his mind swam the vision of Charlotte's swollen belly at the dinner table. Robin wasn't the kind of woman who'd be able to walk away from her child as soon as it left the womb. If Robin was pregnant... Logical and methodical as he usually was, and aware in one part of himself that he was theorizing on scant data, Strike's imagination nevertheless showed him Matthew, the father-to-be, listening in on Robin's tense request for time off for scans and medical checks, gesticulating angrily at her that the time had come to stop, to go easy on herself, to take better care. Strike turned back to Jimmy Knight's blog, but it took him a little longer than usual to discipline his troubled mind back into obedience. Chapter 61. Oh, you can tell me. You and I are such friends, you know. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Fellow tube travellers gave Strike a slightly wider berth than was necessary on Saturday morning, even allowing for his kit bag. He generally managed to cut a path easily through crowds, given his bulk and his boxer's profile. But the way he was muttering and cursing as he struggled up the stairs at Wembley Stadium Station, the lifts weren't working, made passers-by extra careful to neither jostle nor impede him. The primary reason for Strike's bad mood was Mitch Patterson, whom he had spotted that morning from the office window, skulking in a doorway, dressed in jeans and a hoodie, entirely unsuited to his age and bearing. Puzzled and angered by the private detective's reappearance, but having no route out of the building except by the front door, Strike had called a cab to wait for him at the end of the street, and left the building only once it was in position. Patterson's expression when Strike had said, "Morning, Mitch," might have amused Strike, if he hadn't been so insulted that Patterson had thought he could get away with watching the agency in person. All the way to Warren Street Station, where he asked the cab to drop him, Strike had been hyper-alert, worried that Patterson had been there as a distraction or decoy, enabling a second, less obtrusive tale to follow him. Even now, as he clambered, panting, off the top of the stairs at Wembley, he turned to scrutinize the travellers for the one who ducked down, turned back, or hastily concealed their face. None of them did so. On balance, Strike concluded that Patterson had been working alone, victim, perhaps, of one of the manpower problems so familiar to Strike. The fact that Patterson had chosen to cover the job rather than forego it suggested that somebody was paying him well. Strike hoisted his kit bag more securely onto his shoulder and set off towards the exit. Having pondered the question during his inconvenient journey to Wembley, Strike could think of three reasons why Patterson had reappeared. The first was that the press had got wind of some interesting new development in the Met investigation into Chisel's death, and that this had led a newspaper to rehire Patterson, his remit to find out what Strike was up to and how much he knew. The second possibility was that someone had paid Patterson to stalk Strike, in the hope of impeding his movements or hampering his business. That suggested that Patterson's employer was somebody that Strike was currently investigating, in which case Patterson doing the job himself made sense. The whole point would be to destabilize Strike by letting him know that he was being watched. The third possible reason for Patterson's renewed interest in him was the one that bothered Strike most, because he had a feeling it was most likely to be the true one. He now knew that he had been spotted in Franco's with Charlotte. His informant was Izzy, whom he had called in the hope of fleshing out details of the theory he hadn't yet confided to anyone.
"So I hear you had dinner with Charlotte,"
she had blurted, before he had managed to pose a question.
"There was no dinner. I sat with her for 20 minutes because she was feeling ill, then left."
"Oh,"
Sorry, said Izzy, cowed by his tone. I wasn't prying. Roddy Forbes was in Franco's, and he spotted the pair of you. If Roddy Forbes, whoever he was spreading it around London that Strike was taking his heavily pregnant married ex-fiancée out for dinner while her husband was in New York, the tabloids would definitely be interested, because wild, beautiful, and aristocratic Charlotte was news. Her name had peppered gossip columns since she was 16 years old, her various tribulations, running away from school, the stints in rehab and in psychiatric clinics, were well documented. It was even possible that Patterson had been hired by Jago Ross, who could certainly afford it. If the side effect of policing his wife's movements was ruining Strike's business, Ross would undoubtedly consider that a bonus. Robin, who was sitting a short distance away from the station in the Land Rover, saw Strike emerge onto the pavement, kit bag over his shoulder, and registered that he looked as bad-tempered as she had ever seen him. He lit a cigarette, scanning the street, until his eye found the Land Rover at the end of a series of parked vehicles, and he began to limp, unsmiling, towards her. Robin, whose own mood was perilously low, could only assume that he was angry at having to make the long trip to Wembley with what appeared to be a heavy bag and a sore leg. She had been awake since 4 o'clock that morning, unable to get back to sleep, cramped and unhappy on Vanessa's hard sofa, thinking about her future and about the row she had had with her mother by phone. Matthew had called the house in Masham, trying to reach her, and Linda was not only desperately worried, but furious that Robin hadn't told her what was going on first.
"Where are you staying? With Strike?"
"Of course I'm not staying with Strike. Why on earth would I be?"
"Where, then?"
"With a different friend."
"Who? Why didn't you tell us? What are you going to do?"
"I want to come down to London to see you."
"Please don't," said Robin through gritted teeth.
Her guilt about the expense of the wedding she and Matthew had put her parents to, and about the embarrassment her mother and father were about to endure in explaining to their friends that her marriage was over barely a year after it had begun, weighed heavily on her. But she couldn't bear the prospect of Linda badgering and cajoling, treating her as though she were fragile and damaged. The last thing she needed right now was her mother suggesting that she go back to Yorkshire, to be cocooned in the bedroom that had witnessed some of the worst times of her life. After 2 days viewing a multitude of densely packed houses, Robin had put down a deposit on a box room in a house in Kilburn, where she would have 5 other housemates, and into which she would be able to move the following week. Every time she thought of the place, her stomach turned over in trepidation and misery. At the age of almost 28, she would be the oldest housemate. Trying to propitiate Strike, she got out of the car and offered to help him with a kit bag, but he grunted at her that he could manage. As the canvas hit the metal floor of the Land Rover, she heard a loud clattering of heavy metal tools and experienced a nervous spasm in her stomach. Strike, who had taken fleeting stock of Robin's appearance, had his worst suspicions strengthened. Pale, with shadows beneath her eyes, she managed to look both puffy and drawn, and also seemed to have lost weight in the few days since he'd last seen her. The wife of his old army friend, Graham Hardacre, had been hospitalized in the early stages of pregnancy because of persistent vomiting. Perhaps one of Robin's important appointments had been to address that problem.
"You all right?" Strike asked Robin roughly, buckling up his seatbelt.
"Fine," she said, for what felt like the umpteenth time, taking his shortness as annoyance at his long tube journey. They drove out of London without talking. Finally, when they had reached the M40, Strike said,
"Patterson's back. He was watching the office this morning."
"You're kidding.
Has there been anyone round your place?"
"Not that I know of," said Robin, after an almost imperceptible hesitation. Perhaps this was what Matthew had been calling her about, when he had tried to reach her in Masham.
"You didn't have any trouble getting away this morning?"
"No," said Robin, honestly enough. In the days that had elapsed since she'd walked out, she had imagined telling Strike that her marriage was over, but had not yet been able to find a form of words that she knew she would be able to deliver with the requisite calm. This frustrated her. It ought, she told herself, to be easy. He was the friend and colleague who had been there when she'd called off the wedding, and who knew about Matthew's previous infidelity with Sarah. She ought to be able to tell him casually mid-conversation, as she had with Raphael. The problem was that on the rare occasions when she and Strike had shared revelations about their love lives, it had been when one of them had been drunk. Otherwise, a profound reserve on such matters had always lain between them, in spite of Matthew's paranoid conviction that they spent most of their working lives in flirtation. But there was more to it than that. Strike was the man she had hugged on the stairs at her wedding reception, the man with whom she had imagined walking out on her husband before the marriage could be consummated, the man for whom she had spent nights of her honeymoon wearing a groove in the white sand as she paced alone, wondering whether she was in love with him. She was afraid of giving herself away, afraid of betraying what she had thought and felt, because she was sure that if he ever had the merest suspicion of what a disruptive factor he had been, in both the beginning and the end of her marriage, it would surely taint their working relationship, as certainly as it would surely prejudice her job if he ever knew about the panic attacks. No, she must appear to be what he was, self-contained and stoic, able to absorb trauma and limp on, ready to face whatever life flung at her, even what lay at the bottom of the dell, without flinching or turning away. "So what do you think Patterson's up to?" she asked.
"Time will tell. Did your appointments go all right?"
"Yes," said Robin.
And to distract herself from the thought of her tiny new rented room and the student couple who had shown her around, casting sideways glances at the strangely grown-up woman who was coming to live with them, she said, "There are biscuits in the bag there. No tea, sorry. But we can stop if you like."
The thermos was back in Albury Street, one of the things she had forgotten to sneak out of the house when she had returned while Matthew was at work.
"Thanks," said Strike, though without much enthusiasm.
He was wondering whether the reappearance of snacks, given his self-proclaimed diet, might not be further proof of his partner's pregnancy. Robin's phone rang in her pocket. She ignored it. Twice that morning, she had received calls from the same unknown number, and she was afraid that it might be Matthew, who, finding himself blocked, had borrowed another phone.
"You want to get that?" asked Strike, watching her pale, set profile.
Not while I'm driving."
"I can answer it if you want."
"No," she said, a little too quickly. The mobile stopped ringing, but almost at once began again. More than ever convinced that it was Matthew, Robin took the phone out of her jacket, saying, "I think I know who it is, and I don't want to talk to them just now. Once they hang up, could you mute it?"
Strike took the mobile. "It's been put through from the office number. I'll turn it to speakerphone," said Strike helpfully, given that the ancient Land Rover didn't have a functioning heater, let alone Bluetooth, and he did so, holding the mobile close to her mouth so that she could make herself heard over the rattle and growl of the drafty vehicle.
"Hello, Robin here. Who's this?"
"Robin? Don't you mean Venetia?" said a Welsh voice.
"Is that Mr. Wynne?" said Robin,
eyes on the road, while Strike held the mobile steady for her.
"Yes, you nasty little bitch, it is."
Robin and Strike glanced at each other, startled. Gone was the unctuous, lascivious Wynne, keen to charm and impress.
"Got what you were after, haven't you, eh? Wriggling up and down the corridor, sticking your tits in where they weren't wanted. Oh, Mr. Wynne!"
He imitated her, the same way Matthew did, high-pitched and imbecilic.
"Oh, help me, Mr. Wynne. Should I do charity or should I do politics? Let me bend a bit lower over the desk, Mr. Wynne."
"How many men have you trapped that way?
How far do you go?"
"Have you got something to tell me, Mr. Wynne?" asked Robin loudly, talking over him. "Because if you've just called to insult me—"
"Oh, I've got plenty to bloody tell you. Plenty to bloody tell you!"
shouted Wynne.
"You are going to pay, Miss Ellicott, for what you've done to me.
pay for the damage you've done to me and my wife. You don't get off that easily. You broke the law in this office, and I'm going to see you in court. Do you understand me?"
He was becoming almost hysterical.
"We'll see how well your wiles work on a judge, shall we? Low-cut top and, oh, I think I'm overheating."
A white light seemed to be encroaching on the edges of Robin's vision, so that the road ahead turned tunnel-like.
"No!"
she shouted, taking both hands off the wheel before slamming them back down again, her arms shaking. It was the no she had given to Matthew, a no of such vehemence and force that it brought Geraint Wynne up short in exactly the same way.
"Nobody made you stroke my hair and pat my back and ogle my chest, Mr. Wynne. That wasn't what I wanted, though I'm sure it gives you a bit of a kick to think it was."
"Robin," said Strike.
But he might as well have been one more creak of the car's ancient chassis, and she ignored, too, Geraint's sudden interjection.
"Who else is there? Was that Strike? You're a creep, Mr. Wynne. A thieving creep who stole from a charity, and I'm not only happy I got the goods on you, I'll be delighted to tell the world you're flicking out pictures of your dead daughter while you're trying to peer down young women's shirts."
"How dare you?" gasped Wynne.
"Are there no depths you dare mention Rhiannon? It's all going to come out. Samuel Merapi's family. Screw you and screw your bloody grudges," shouted Robin. "You're a pervy thieving—"
"If you've got anything else to say, I suggest you put it in writing, Mr. Wynne,"
Strike shouted into the mobile, while Robin, hardly knowing what she was doing, continued to yell insults at Wynne from a distance. Ending the call with a jab of the finger, Strike grabbed the wheel as Robin again removed both hands from it to gesticulate.
"Fuck's sake," said Strike. "Pull over. Pull over, now."
She did as he told her automatically, the adrenaline disorientating her like alcohol. And when the Land Rover lurched to a halt, she threw off her seatbelt and got out on the hard shoulder, cars whizzing past her. Hardly knowing what she was doing, she began to stumble away from the Land Rover, tears of rage sliding down her face, trying to outpace the panic now lapping at her, because she had just irrevocably alienated a man they might need to talk to again, a man who had already been talking about revenge, who might even be the one paying Patterson.
"Robin!"
Now, she thought, Strike too would think her a flake, a damaged fool who should never have taken on this line of work, the one who ran when things got tough. It was that which made her wheel around to face him as he hobbled along the hard shoulder after her, and she wiped her face roughly on her sleeve and said, before he could tell her off,
"I know I shouldn't have lost it. I know I fucked up. I'm sorry."
But his answer was lost in the pounding in her ears, and, as though it had been waiting for her to stop running, the panic now engulfed her. Dizzy, unable to order her thoughts, she collapsed on the verge, dry bristles of grass prickling through her jeans, as, eyes shut and head in hands, she tried to breathe herself back to normality as the traffic zoomed past. She wasn't quite sure whether 1 minute or 10 had elapsed, but finally her pulse slowed, her thoughts became ordered, and the panic ebbed away, to be replaced by mortification. After all her careful pretense that she was coping, she had blown it. A whiff of cigarette smoke reached her. Opening her eyes, she saw Strike's leg sticking out on the ground to her right. He too had sat down on the verge.
"How long have you been having panic attacks?"
he asked conversationally. There seemed no point dissembling any more. "About a year," she muttered.
"Been getting help with them?"
"Yes, I was in therapy for a bit. Now I do CBT exercises."
"Do you, though?" asked Strike mildly. "Because I bought vegetarian bacon a week ago, but it's not making me any healthier, just sitting there in the fridge."
Robin began to laugh and found that she couldn't stop. More tears leaked from her eyes. Strike watched her, not unkindly, smoking his cigarette.
"I could have been doing them a bit more regularly,"
Robin admitted at last, mopping her face again.
"Anything else you fancy telling me, now we're getting into things?" asked Strike.
He felt he ought to know the worst now,
before he gave her any advice on her mental condition, but Robin seemed confused.
"Any other health matters that might affect your ability to work?" he prompted her.
"Like what?"
Strike wondered whether a direct inquiry constituted some kind of infringement of her employment rights.
"I wondered," he said, "whether you might be, pregnant."
Robin began to laugh again.
"Oh, God, that's funny."
"Is it?"
"No," she said, shaking her head. "I'm not pregnant."
Strike now noticed that her wedding and engagement rings were missing. He had become so used to seeing her without them as she impersonated Venetia Hall and Bobby Cunliffe that it had not occurred to him that their absence today might be significant. Yet he didn't want to pose a direct question, for reasons that had nothing at all to do with employment rights.
"Matthew and I have split up," Robin said, frowning at the passing traffic in an effort not to cry again. "A week ago."
"Oh," said Strike. "Shit, I'm sorry."
But his concerned expression was at total odds with his actual feelings. His dark mood had lightened so abruptly that it was akin to having moved from sober to 3 pints down. The smell of rubber and dust and burned grass recalled the car park where he had accidentally kissed her, and he drew on his cigarette again and tried hard not to let his feelings show in his face.
"I know I shouldn't have spoken to Geraint Wynne like that," said Robin, tears now falling again. "I shouldn't have mentioned Rhiannon. I lost control and it's just men, bloody men, judging everyone by their bloody selves."
"What happened with Matt?"
"He's been sleeping with Sarah Shadlock," said Robin savagely. "His best friend's fiance. She left an earring in our bed and I... Oh, bugger."
It was no use. She buried her face in her hands and, with a sense of having nothing to lose now, cried in earnest, because she had thoroughly disgraced herself in Strike's eyes, and the one remaining piece of her life that she had been seeking to preserve had been tainted. How delighted Matthew would be to see her falling apart on a motorway verge, proving his point that she was unfit to do the job she loved, forever limited by her past, by having, twice, been in the wrong place at the wrong time, with the wrong men. A heavy weight landed across her shoulders. Strike had put his arm around her. This was simultaneously comforting and ominous, because he had never done that before, and she was sure that this was the precursor to him telling her that she was unfit to work, that they would cancel the next interview and return to London.
"Where have you been staying?"
"Vanessa's sofa," said Robin, trying frantically to mop her streaming eyes and nose. Snot and tears had made the knees of her jeans soggy. "But I've got a new place now."
"Where?"
"Kilburn. A room in a shared house."
"Bloody hell, Robin," said Strike. "Why didn't you tell me? Nick and Ilsa have got a proper spare room. They'd be delighted."
"I can't sponge off your friends," said Robin thickly.
"It wouldn't be sponging," said Strike.
He jammed his cigarette in his mouth and started searching his pockets with his free hand.
"They like you, and you could stay there for a couple of weeks until... Aha! I thought I had one. It's only creased. I haven't used it. Don't think so, anyway."
Robin took the tissue and, with one hearty blow of her nose, demolished it.
"Listen," Strike began.
But Robin interrupted at once.
"Don't tell me to take time off. Please don't. I'm fine. I'm fit to work. I hadn't had a panic attack in ages before that one. I'm..."
"Not listening."
"All right, sorry," she muttered,
the sodden tissue clutched in her fist.
"Go on."
"After I got blown up, I couldn't get in a car without doing what you've just done. Panicking and breaking out in a cold sweat and half suffocating. For a while, I'd do anything to avoid being driven by someone else. I've still got problems with it, to tell the truth."
"I didn't realize," said Robin. "You don't show it."
"Yeah, well, you're the best driver I know. You should see me with my bloody sister. Thing is, Robin..." "Oh, bollocks,"
The traffic police had arrived, pulling up behind the abandoned Land Rover, apparently puzzled as to why the occupants were sitting 50 yards away on the verge, to all appearances unconcerned with the fate of their poorly parked vehicle.
"Not in too much of a hurry to get help, then,"
said the portlier of the two sarcastically. He had the swagger of a man who thinks himself a joker. Strike removed his arm from around Robin's shoulders, and both stood up, in Strike's case, clumsily.
"Car sickness," Strike told the officer blandly. "Careful, or she might puke on you."
They returned to the car. The first officer's colleague was peering at the tax disc on the ancient Land Rover.
"You don't see many of this age still on the roads," he commented.
"It's never let me down yet," said Robin.
"Sure you're all right to drive?"
Strike muttered, as she turned the ignition key.
"We could pretend you're still feeling ill."
"I'm fine."
And this time it was true. He had called her the best driver he knew, and it might not be much, but he had given her back some of her self-respect, and she steered seamlessly back onto the motorway. There was a long silence. Strike decided that further discussion of Robin's mental health ought to wait until she wasn't driving. "Wynne said a name at the end of the call there," he mused, taking out his notebook.
"Did you hear?"
"No," muttered Robin, shamefaced.
"It was Samuel something," Strike said, making a note. "Murdoch, Matlock?"
"I didn't hear."
"Cheer up," said Strike bracingly. "He probably wouldn't have blurted it out if you hadn't been yelling at him. Not that I recommend calling interviewees thieving perverts in future."
He stretched around in his seat, reaching for the carrier bag in the back.
"Fancy a biscuit?"
Chapter 62. "I do not want to see your defeat, Rebecca." Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. The car park at Newbury Racecourse was already jam-packed when they arrived. Many of the people heading for the ticket marquee were dressed for comfort, like Strike and Robin, in jeans and jackets. But others had donned fluttering silk dresses, suits, padded waistcoats, tweed hats and corduroy trousers in shades of mustard and puce that reminded Robin of Torquil. They queued for tickets, each lost in their thoughts. Robin was afraid of what was coming once they reached the crafty filly where Tegan Butcher worked. Certain that Strike had not yet had his full say on her mental health, she was afraid that he had merely postponed the announcement that he wanted her to return to a desk job in the office. In fact, Strike's mind was temporarily elsewhere. The white railings glimpsed beyond the small marquee where the crowd queued for tickets, and the abundance of tweed and corduroy were reminding him of the last time he had been at a racecourse. He had no particular interest in the sport. The one constant paternal figure in his life, his Uncle Ted, had been a footballing and sailing man, and while a couple of Strike's friends in the army had enjoyed a bet on the horses, he had never seen the attraction. 3 years previously, though, he had attended the Epsom Derby with Charlotte and two of her favourite siblings. Like Strike, Charlotte came from a disjointed and dysfunctional family. In one of her unpredictable effusions of enthusiasm, Charlotte had insisted on accepting Valentine and Sasha's invitation, notwithstanding Strike's lack of interest in the sport and his barely cordial feelings towards both men, who considered him an inexplicable oddity in their sister's life. He had been broke at the time, setting up the agency on a shoestring, already being chased by lawyers for repayment of the small loan he had taken from his biological father, when every bank had turned him down as a bad risk. Nevertheless, Charlotte had been incensed when, after losing a fiver on the nose on the favourite, Fame and Glory, who had come in second, he had refused to place another bet. She had refrained from calling him puritanical or sanctimonious, plebeian or penny-pinching, as she had done previously when he had refused to emulate the reckless and ostentatious spending of her family and friends. Egged on by her brothers, she had chosen to lay larger and larger bets herself, finally winning £2,500 and insisting that they visit the champagne tent, where her beauty and high spirits had turned many heads. As he walked with Robin up a wide tarmac thoroughfare that ran parallel from the racetrack itself behind